This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Also sponsored by Windstar Farm. Now here's Mike Pena.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is indeed Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton, and it's right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch, in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, and welcoming everyone joining us throughout North America on Sirius 220 XM Channel 206, and everyone tuning in worldwide with our live streaming on your computer, your smartphone, or your tablet, and that's all at horseracingradio.net. Every single week, I get to visit with the men and the women that make our sport a success. And, you know, as always, I'm talking about the trainers. And this week is no exception. A father-son combination on Trainer Talk for you tonight. And the first half, going to be joined by Gerald Bennett. And then second half of the program, we will welcome his son, Dale Bennett. And it's going to be neat to hear those two stories and the two different aspects of training horses, because Gerald has been doing this for a very long time. Dale, not quite as long. And Dale credits his dad for all of his success. Well, we're going to talk to his dad right now. He's a 71-year-old native of Nova Scotia who has been training horses on his own for nearly four decades. He is currently ranked 19th all-time among North American trainers in victories and 12th among all active trainers. His win total currently stands at 3,510, and his runners have earned more than $33 million in purses. Gerald Bennett is with me now on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Jared, welcome to the show, my friend.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, happy to have you on board here. And boy, you think about that number, 3,510 winners. When you hear that number, could you ever imagine?
No, not well. Even when I left Nova Scotia, I came up and I started working, you know, several different jobs and machine shop and sheet metal, and then A&P and stuff, and doing those jobs, working three jobs at a time, and gradually, you know, finally weaned over to just the horses.
Wow. And then when you think back on everything you've been able to accomplish, it has to be, I would imagine, somewhat surreal, isn't it?
Yeah, well, just fell into have a, you know, a natural thing going for you with the horses, like a psychic or whatever, and everything just fell in. And then I guess from there on out, a lot of things happened from hard work, and good Lord took good care of me and being in the right place and getting some nice horses over the years, claiming horses, and had some other, you know, real good runners. It's been a lot of horses going through and a lot of different changes, and met a lot of really great people, because the racing world's like that, and you get to meet a lot more people than you would in any other industry.
I want to go back to the beginning and ask you about growing up in Nova Scotia and how you first got introduced to horse racing. But before we do, let's talk about win number 3,500, because it happened recently on March 28th. At Tampa Bay Downs. Your filly, Once More for Love, won the fifth race that day, and you finally broke over the hump and got to number 3,500. Take me back to that day and tell me about that.
Well, it seems once after you get up to the 34, or the one before the 35, it seemed like it was we had quite a few live spots in, but this and that, it never happened, and I guess in any... the jockeys or something that just seems like it takes to get that last one, a lot of difficult things happening or whatever. I don't know, just the way their rapport is off it. And then when you get that one, it's the next win. And then immediately after that, we won another race. So it's a great accomplishment. And the people at Tampa are, they have a lot of great horse people there that really appreciate the trainers, and they come talk to you and say hello, and it's, they have a good rapport going, and it's one of the things that we're starting to miss is the public, you know, having a lot of people attending the races, and you get a good rapport going with them. You get your followers that root for you and help your inner energy in the races, and it's great when you've got a lot of people that follow you and respect you like that. It's a great feeling.
Well, the great part about that milestone win is you never had to sweat it out because she won so easy. I think she won by more than five lengths that day. And for those of us like myself who have never had the opportunity to saddle a horse, Gerald, what are those emotions like when you finally do get over that hump, get to that milestone, and you're watching her pull away in the stretch?
Yeah, it's a great thrill. It's, to me, I've had... I get that kind of thrill in winning all the races, whether it's a $2,500 claimer or whatever. It's, people don't realize what it takes just to win the race and on a daily basis, because of all the things that can happen just by general horse racing. So it's a great feeling, and I've been through a lot of different milestones in my lifetime, getting to if you have better horses, like when I had Bo Genius or something, that I know what you go through a lot of pressure from having to perform for the owners, and there's been a lot of ups and downs and times when you think you should have romped and you don't get nothing, and it's the horse racing that way.
Yeah, it certainly is.
You can't let it get you upset. You just move right on to the next race, and that way you'll keep being successful.
You're 100% right, and I have had so many trainers come on this program, Gerald, and they tell me that one of the big things that makes them successful is the support that they get from their family. And after that win, you were joined by your wife, Mary, your son, Dale, and so many of your other friends in the winner's circle. Tell me about that moment. What does that mean to have that support?
It's a great feeling, and know you have a lot of people behind you, and a lot of friends that rooting you on every day. People, my phone never stopped ringing from all over the place, and just congratulating me, and thanks, for even where the people that we had been training for more than 30 years. Some of them were wishing they could be there. They'd be there on the other days, and then you wouldn't get it. So that's just a thrill. That it's like winning a race from the owner with his first horse. There's no thrill like it you can get in life. I mean, you either bred the horse or bought the horse, and you own them, and you get your first win. I know what that's like for new owners in the game, and how great a feeling it is, and they have all their friends there on that day. It's a great thrill.
Your wife Mary had a great quote after the race when she said, "I want to slow down, but he wants to keep going, so I guess I have to follow." I thought that was outstanding. You're still going strong, 71 years young, and this game is still what gets in your blood, isn't it?
Yes, that's she keeps asking me when you're going to stop. I tell her, well, probably when they're shoveling the dirt over me. Because every day there's an accomplishment has to be done with yourself. We're breeding some mares. I don't know. I think we must be crazy getting in the breeding business. We've been breeding some of our own, and the few bad things happening, they mare doesn't make it, the baby doesn't make it, and we had that happen this year with one of our better mares. But you just gotta keep striving at it to get to the spot where you want to be. And every trainer, would like to get to the Derby and win the races. I got to the Breeders' Cup the one time, but kind of the owners called the last shot, and I should have been in the sprint. And I had Bo Genius. I think he's the best sprinter in the country at that time. But they wanted to go in the Classic, and he still ran big, but I'll get back there again. The other thrill that I had was when I had Bo, and he was winning all them, and he won Shoemaker's last race. So that was a great, great day at Gulfstream when he won that race, and then that happened to be his last winning ride. So that was a great time.
Wow, that's quite a thrill. What do you remember when Shoemaker came back? What did he say to you after the race?
Well, Dave Pena is dead now, the rider, and he made a comment to me as he was going past in the winner's circle. And he says, I don't know how you ever got through there, but Shoemaker said that Bo Genius did it all. He saw a little hole, and he shot through it. And he said, I have a letter somewhere from him in the file somewhere. And he said the horse was one of the fastest horses that he'd rode, in the end of his career anyway. And he said he was like grease lightning. So we have a lot of those pictures like that. And when we were on the roll with him, that's I can understand how these people are, like with the horse last year that won the Derby. They'll never have that kind of thrill in their memories. They're going to carry all that, right to their grave. So I was really happy for those people. They had that horse, and everybody else is going to be somebody the next year. And this year, kind of looks like it's going to. Baffert's got the one horse there. It looks like it.
Yeah, yeah, it certainly appears to be. And as we know, though, that mile and a half can derail even the greatest of horses. We've seen it over the years, where it really separates the men from the boys, doesn't it?
Well, in my knowledge with the horse racing, with that, I guess, every trainer is going to have their own opinion. But when you come and you train to a certain race, those horses, are to me, those races are going, they're on that day, you peak your horse for that day, and you come to do the dance, then don't try to change your mind and maybe we should do this or maybe we should do that, take him back. Let the horse run his race. If you get beat, you get beat. You prepared him for that. If it's a mile and a half, many a horse has done it wire to wire. Let him do his thing, what he is. That's the way I would, if I ever get there, that's what it's going to be. If he's a front runner, that's where he's going to be. Come and catch him.
Yeah, yeah. Talking with Gerald Bennett here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I want to go back to Bo Genius for just a minute, because like you, Gerald, he was Canadian bred. He earned more than $1 million. You mentioned probably the best sprinter in the country. He won 19 races. Tell me his story here for just a minute.
Well, Dr. Bedane, when I first started training, he used to let me read a lot of his books and medical books and stuff, and he helped me a lot. He's passed away now in Woodbine when I first started training. And I went there, and I was running in Detroit and Hazel Park and shipping around here and there with the old Commodore track. And I came back to pick up some horses, and I was in the kitchen, and George came in. He said, Gary, how long are you here for? I said, just today. He said, well, I know a horse that's just your kind of horse. He's got problems. He's had surgery a couple of times. He's now been out on the farm for a while. Jerry Ballinger had him, and they just can't get him back to the races and get him going right. And he says, I know you'll straighten him out and do good with him. And he had knee surgery a couple of times. He said, I'm going to call the people and tell them to send this horse, and you can come pick him up. And that was the start of it. And I picked him up that day and brought him on to Detroit, and he'd been turned out in a field. He was kind of skinny from being on grass and stuff, and we got him up there. And when I got him in the barn, because I know he had beat one of Gord Huntley's good horses at a mile down at Greenwood before he got the injuries.
Yeah.
And I told my boys in the barn, I said, hey, this best horse we've ever had in here in a long time. And he had the diarrhea going on the walls and everything. And they all looked at me. Are you crazy? But the rest is kind of history. And he was a runner, and he didn't want to lose. Great horse. We all cried when he left the barn.
No, I'm sure. And that's one thing that when people think back on trainers and what they go through on a daily basis, they don't realize how close you become to so many of the horses that are in your barn. They really do become like your kids, don't they, Gerald?
Yeah, they're they're about as close, well, to me, they all are. They're all my kids, and they all know me when I go in the barn. And that's another thing about training horses. Their personalities, you have to take your help that you have and put the horse's personality and that groom's personality together. Some horses need a groom that's real quiet and gentle and talks to them all the time. Other ones can take a groom that doesn't really have that kind of attention on a horse, but they're good grooms, but they just don't into, well, you know, making a fuss over them and all that. And that's a big part in training to keep the horse happy. Make sure you got the right groom's personality with the horse's personality. And I think you'd get a lot more run out of horses by watching that part.
Yeah, it's interesting. And then I've also seen you quoted before as saying that you kind of get the feeling that you have a somewhat of a sixth sense that horses are communicating with you. Is that true?
Oh, I believe in it.
Yeah.
If you don't have that sixth sense of feeling, that's what I think makes the good trainers. They pick up on a lot of things more quickly, and over the years, I've had horses and I've watched a lot when they're galloping out and they're finishing out, or even in the gallop in the morning, you can pick up a lot when the horse turns and get a lot from them. I had one horse once. I had a vet X-ray him and mention any names all about three or four times, and I told him this horse has got a problem in the cannon bone there somewhere. When he turns, and we X-rayed him. Of course, they have better machines now, and said, "Well, there's nothing wrong with the horse. Go ahead and run him." And he fractured the next start. He was not a nice horse, a high price claimer. We had to operate on him, put screws, and come back and win a bunch more races with him. But if the technology would have been there, he was showing me, but the X-rays didn't show anything. But it's just part of everything's getting better and better and better in the industry and a lot of things, and picking up on horses help you find things. It's advancing technology. It's great.
Yeah, it makes a big difference. So let's go back to the beginning here for just a minute, Gerald. How does a kid growing up in Nova Scotia become hooked on thoroughbred racing?
Well, I was working three jobs, and then I used to run a Shell station, gas station, on the weekends and look after the books and stuff for Howie Haskett and Jane and Wilson, the Crang Plaza. And the older gentleman, they had some horses at Woodbine, and he'd come in there and get his service and his vehicle and get gas all the time. And his name happened to be Jerry, too. And he said, "Well, why don't you come out to the races?" They were running a horse the one day they liked, and he said, "Come on out to the track." And the horse won that day and paid like $48. And I took another friend of mine out with me. So, of course, then after, you know, that part, you're hooked. So then I start going to the track in the mornings. And the weekend, started hot walking and doing generally everything, just working with them. And then eventually I got into being there all the time. At that time, you had to be on the backside of approximately 5 years or more before you could get a trainer's test.
Sure.
And the rest is just started out with it. And then how I got the owners, I lived up above a meat store, and there was a guy who had a paint business, sell tile and all kinds of stuff, Al Tucci. And we all used to come in and talk, and then, okay, we'd go to the races. So four of us got together and started Sun Stable, put money in, and started claiming. And then, of course, then we had Sun Stable and win a lot of races at Woodbine. And that's kind of how we got started with four people, put $5,000 each in, and we made about $90,000 profit the first year, and then after that, we just start claiming and turning horses over.
Wow, that's a great story. Was it mostly just claiming horses, or would you go to the sale to pick some out?
No, at that time, mostly claiming horses. The first horse I ever had that won his first time out, Victorian Sun, I did buy him off of the farm for $2,500, and he won his first time out at Greenwood Racetrack. And after that, well, mostly was all claiming. I used to go to the rail all the time and say, well, I wonder, you know, why they're not claiming this horse and then we say, well, get into the business and start it from there. And like hard work, I'd be working, I'd get off at work till 3:30 in the morning, get off there, go to the track, muck the horses out, feed them, and then at that time I had six, and Larry Attard would come over, gallop one, and then come back, and I'd get them all myself. And then my wife would water the horses off at night while I worked at A&P, and I'd come and do the horses, and then eventually I, you know, just started into getting a bigger stable and straight with the horses.
Wow. What do you consider to be your first really big break that got your career started?
Most probably in Detroit, I got with some pretty good owners, Tony Cananacci and Hugo Leonardi. They own Plastic Mold Injection Companies, both of them. And if I wanted to buy a horse for the bigger money, $60,000, $80,000, $100,000, or $75,000, well, they were the owners that I could go down to Miami or buy a horse or go and buy. These were older horses that were already running, or buy a group of horses. And we just kind of started from there. And then Hugo was breeding some, so we bred a lot of state breds. And then I got training for Jimmy Arnold, who's passed away, which I hadn't been training state bred horses for all those years. And then I got into training them. And then I had purchased Secret Romeo, who won all kinds of state races and track record. He put the track record at Tampa and beat a horse that Mark Cassie had just won the Man of War, the great stake in New York. And he equaled the track record that day, and he won several open races. I think Bonaparte beat us a nose over in Arlington. He went on and won champion sprinter of the year that year.
Yeah.
Then I had another horse who we had a lot of fun with. I cleaned off of Bernie Flint for $10,000. We made almost $900,000 with him, a horse called Lombardi Time.
How did you know which horses were the right horses to claim? And I'm sure you weren't right all the time, but you've had a lot of success with those claiming horses and moving them up. How did you know when you were just getting started which ones were the ones you wanted to have in your stable?
Oh, by watching, looking at their legs as much as you could, going over and how they were, watching the races and the horses. You know, they had great hair color. I found out early enough, just don't be claiming ones that were, you know, and trying to, because they looked bad or something, trying to improve on them that way. When I started out, I used to say, well, if I claim them for 10 in 30 days, will he win for 8? And taking that look at it, they all turned, most of them, a lot of them turned out pretty good. And then not by thinking, well, you can improve on somebody or anything like that. Just you get a runner, a horse that shows he loves to win. And that's mostly what you need. You need that. You can't tell even when you're going to sale to buy horses like that. But if you have an eye that you like a horse that looks a certain way, and every trainer has their way they want. When you feel you have that one or find the one, I just bought one for a new client at the last sale in Ocala. I kind of feel that maybe this is the one. Maybe this is the one I'm getting to the Derby with. He's by Blame out of Empire Maker Mare.
Ooh.
And
nice.
I've had some nice horses, either claimers or whatever, over the years. And if he can stay sound, he's training like that right now. I think he's. I think he might be the one. I don't want to jinx myself or nothing, but he's just great.
Well, you've mentioned the Kentucky Derby a couple of times, and believe it or not, Gerald, we're running out of time. It's hard to believe this has really flown by, but we have about 3 minutes left. But you mentioned the Kentucky Derby a couple of times. How much do you want to get there and have a horse start underneath the Twin Spires?
Well, that's a lifetime dream from when I used to watch Lou Cavalieris at Woodbine I'd never been to out of Canada in my life. And then when you watched all those horses like Damascus and all the horses when we were starting out in our career, when all those horses, some of the high weight they used to carry, and then at that time Lou had won the Derby with Dancer's Image, and he was, everybody knew about him in Canada, how good he was, and he had a couple other nice horses, so, and he used to go away to the Gulfstream and bring in the horses to Woodbine and kill them. And so, that's the way he used to go. Only one thing, when I over the last couple of years, Dale, he used to always calls me and tells me, Dad, you're getting old. You're slowing down on winning the races. You're not winning the way you used to. He said, you know, you're not taking any edge. Start entering those horses the right way. Larry Ullman's passed away now, and there's times you always have a lot of camaraderie with the jokes and stuff, and Larry Ullman said, Ben, I've been feeding my family running second to you for all these years. I said to him, well, give me your condition book. Let me enter them for you. But you always have that, you know, you have those things in your life among all the trainers and good respect for each other and a lot of camaraderie and the thing. And the great one time I used to have James Jackson, you know, Mel Tillis, the country and western singer.
Yeah.
How he stuttered. And his best friend was named Doodah, another boy, and they were playing down by the pond, and Doodah fell in the pond. And Mel Tillis couldn't get him out, so he run up, and he's pounding on the door, and he's saying, stuttering, ponds. He said, what are you trying to tell me? So he said, guess who drowned in the pond today, Doodah, Doodah. So I was telling James Jackson this story in the morning, and I had a three-year-old running in one of the stakes. At that time, the pot was $45,000. He said, Jerry, I know you're a great, good trainer and everything. What are you doing running this three-year-old in here against the older horses? So I told him that joke in the morning. So Little Moose was the name of the horse. He wins the race. So coming down the stairs, I remember what I told him. So I started singing to him, guess who drowned in the pond today? So
those are great.
Great things of your life.
Yeah, Gerald Bennett here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I mentioned, Gerald, that your son Dale is coming up in just a couple of minutes here. He's going to be with us in the second half of the program. And again, have to get to wrap it up here in just about 1 minute. But wanted to ask you, did you want Dale to be a trainer and follow in your footsteps?
Well, he worked for me hot walking for a long time, and then I started putting him on horses, and he was grooming and everything, and he wanted to get on his own. He was with me about 15 years, and he's done a great job, and I'm happy for him. And it was time for him to get going on his own, and he's been doing that and doing a great job for a long time now.
Gerald, we could have spent another hour talking about your life and your career, and I could hear your stories all day long. I really appreciate you taking the time to be with me on the show tonight, and we'll look forward to catching up with you down the road.
Yes, thank you. Thanks for calling me.
All the best, Gotcha. Gerald Bennett.
Okay.
On Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton, like all of our guests, going to receive a gift courtesy of Flair Equine Nasal Strips, so we will send those up to Gerald. And his son Dale is coming up next. The fun continues, a father-son duo. On Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton, right here on HRN. Attention, calling all racehorses. Nominations are now open for the 2015 Fasig Tipton Selected Summer Horses of Racing Age Sale to be held immediately following the July Selected Yearling Sale on July 9th in Lexington, Kentucky. It's the hottest sale of the summer, boasting a $77,000 average and a sale topper of $1,075,000 in 2014. The sale attracts major buyers who are there for one purpose, to buy. 128 horses were offered at last year's sale, a whopping 109 horses sold to 78 unique buyers, with 20 horses topping the $100,000 mark. Go online to nominate your horse today at HORANominations2015.com. That's HORANominations2015.com. The Fasig Tipton Selected Summer Horses of Racing Age Sale and the July Selected Yearling Sale. July 9th at the Fasig Tipton Sale Pavilion on Newtown Pike in Lexington, Kentucky.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. to breed the best, to race the best, and to stand the best. Windstar Farm, dedicated to the dream.
And they're off to New York, the premier state bred program in the United States. When you own a New York bred, your horse can run for more than $44 million in purses restricted to registered New York breds. And the New York program pays awards to breeders, owners, and stallion owners when their New York breds finish first, second, or third at New York tracks. We have the quality.
Day at the spa, all the way.
You have the opportunity. New York breds, get with the program, the best program.
From start to finish, the $500,000 Grade 3 Penn Mile is the biggest and most exciting race of the year in central Pennsylvania. This year's best three-year-old grass horses will be at Penn National Saturday, May 30th for the 2015 Penn Mile. Last year, sensational winner Bobby's Kitten went on to win the $1 million Breeders' Cup Turf Sprint Championship. The Penn Mile program features more than $1 million in purses, and the all-stakes pick four starts with first race post time at 6 p.m.
Since 2006, the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund has provided critical financial assistance to some 60 riders who have sustained catastrophic on-track injuries. The lives of these former athletes who have given so much to the sport of horse racing have been changed forever. I'm Mike Penna, president of the Horse Racing Radio Network and proud supporter of the PDJF, and I ask you to join me in supporting this outstanding organization right now by texting the word jockey to 50555. You'll be credited with a $10 donation that can literally change the lives of those disabled riders who need it so much. It's quick, it's easy, and it's only $10. Who would think a simple $5 Exacta box would mean so much to so many? So let's all help make a huge difference in the lives of those riders who have given us so many great memories. Text the word jockey to 50555 today and visit pdjf.org to learn more. Message and data rates may apply. Terms, mgive.org/chi. Hi, this is Mike Penna. Join me and our entire Horse Racing Radio Network team as we broadcast live from Belmont Park beginning Wednesday, June 3rd with three consecutive Triple Crown Countdown shows from 8 to 10 a.m. Eastern. We'll bring you all the latest information and updates on the 147th Belmont Stakes and get you ready for American Pharoah's Run at Triple Crown history. So join us for three Triple Crown Countdown shows Wednesday, June 3rd through Friday, June 5th from 8 to 10 a.m. Eastern and see a complete Belmont Week schedule at horseracingradio.net. Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, in our Lexington studios and continuing with a special father-son edition here on Trainer Talk. And boy, what a great visit in the first half of the program. Gerald Bennett, some stories there. And he could, when I told him when I let him go that we could spend another hour talking about his life and his career and hear some of his stories, I meant it because I didn't feel like we ever really scratched the surface with Gerald, and I may have to get him back on for a part two. It was that amazing to visit with him. And the second half of the program should be equally as amazing because I will be joined by his son, Dale, who is currently stabled at Arlington Park in Chicago. And he's done a tremendous job throughout much of his career. You look back and see what he's done. Well, he's trained 589 winners to date. He's closing in on the $10 million mark in purse earnings with his runners. Now, if you're wondering, that's only about 2,900 wins behind his dad, but that's all right. He'll get there. And he joins us now on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Dale, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
But let me tell you, I had so much fun with your dad in the first half of the program. It was so enjoyable to hear his story. And when I meant that he has stories, he has stories.
Yeah, he's amazing. He really is. He really is.
Well, look, I mentioned that number, 589 wins. You're doing quite well on your own, and your dad just reached that 3,500 win milestone, which we talked about in the first half of the show. What was it like for you to be there for him when he reached that milestone at Tampa back at the end of March?
No, it gave me goosebumps. I was so proud of him. As a matter of fact, my wife had if you go and maybe if you can find the picture in the winner's circle, she had all these T-shirts made up. And it's funny you mentioned my wins, because on my T-shirt it says, my dad's won 3,500 races. And then underneath it says, I only have 2,900 and whatever it was, such and such to go. So she had all these T-shirts, you know, and my daughter was there. She's only five. And she goes, it says, my grandpa's won 3,500 races. And underneath it says, how many has yours won? So we had all these little shirts made up. And I was, you know, I was, you know, for the few days before he got it, you know, we were always made sure we were at the races and, you know, just waiting for it to happen. But, you know, he certainly deserves it. He's not your typical trainer. I mean, he's just the hardest working man you'll ever meet, and up and down the road, and, you know, shifts a lot of his own horses, and just, you know, if somebody asked me, how's my dad doing? I'm saying, you know, it's not how he's doing, it's where is he? I don't know if he's on the road or what track he's at. He's just, he never stops. I don't know how he does it, to be honest with you. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it is. 71 years young. And he told a story about when he was first getting started, and he was working at A&P, and he would work there until 3:30 in the morning. Then he would go straight to the barns to tend to the horses right after that. And just that dedication that it took to get started for him is quite remarkable.
Yep, it absolutely is. And you know, I was raised on the farm that we had up in Canada, and you know, that's I sort of where the bug bit me. But I used to work in the barn and help swim the horses and tend to the hot walking machine and clean up the barn, and that's where it started. But I was into sports when I was a kid, and then my first year I went to work for my dad, I think I was like 15, I went to a DRC, and I just, you know, had a summer job, and I went to hot walk. And then after that, it was over. As soon as I graduated high school, I was like, I was gone. I went to New Orleans to work for him at the track, and I've been there ever since. So it got in my blood, and I tried to quit after a little bit. I stopped, and I said, you know, I want a quote unquote normal job where you get weekends off and, you know, 9 to 5, and I actually got like a detailing cars job up in Canada. I went back, and like every moment of the day, it was like, oh, well, you know, it's almost post time. And I'm thinking, oh, it's almost the second race, or, you know, oh, the horse is getting fed about now. I had to go back. It was like, I couldn't, doesn't matter if it's, you know, because the horses are 7 days a week and, you know, almost 24 hours a day. It doesn't matter if it's Christmas or New Year's. It doesn't matter. You know, you have to be there to tend to them. But it didn't matter. Just, I couldn't stop thinking about the horses and the racetrack and the lifestyle, so I went back.
Have you ever had the chance to talk to jockey CC Lopez about detailing your vehicles?
No.
He joined us on Jock Talk this past week, and he was telling me that that's his hobby. When he gets away from the track, he will clean his car, vacuum his car, and detail his car. He'll do it 4 times a day. Because he just loves doing it, and he gets to stop and think about what's going on in his life when he's doing it. So maybe something to keep in mind when you run into him up the road.
That might be a little OCD, sounds like to me.
Yeah.
I know a lot of the racetrackers' cars, at least as far as mine and my wife's, are they're not detailed to any extent.
Well, he is a jockey, so what can you say, right?
Right.
So what was your first job on the family farm?
Well, I actually was sweeping, you know, as we'd go down the shed road, and all the boys were cleaning the stalls, I would have to go behind them, and because the whole barn was concrete, so I would sweep behind them, making sure the whole barn was clean. That's the earliest I remember. And then we had, as I got older and grew up, we had a hot walking machine, and my next job was to make sure that none of the horses stopped the wheel, which means they stop, you know, they pull back and they won't walk. And I had to like crack a little whip just to keep them going. And then it kind of moved from there to actually getting to swim some of the horses in the pool, and then starting with leg work and so on and so forth, things of that nature. Because basically it was, we did have a training track, but it was more of a gravel training track, more set up for standardbreds, but we did more rehab. Like they would send horses to the farm with problems or issues or layups, and they would need to stop training but go on to swim the horses. you know, or, you know, do some leg work and kind of rehabilitate him. And then that's kind of where my dad, you know, taught me, and we all, and he got really good at rehabbing the horses, which is where Bo Genius started from. You know, he came to my dad at DRC pretty much as a broke down horse, was running for 7,500, either at Woodbine or DRC, I don't remember, and went to a grade one winner. So
yeah,
that's where all of that kind of snowballed. And that's where, you know, we learned how to work on horses. I remember one of our first years, we shipped down to Gulfstream Park, and we were in the same barn as Due Process Stables at the time. They had the hare, and we were from Detroit, and then they had these grooms on the backside, and we would, you know, walk our horse around the other side, and we're looking at the grooms boxes, and they have just basically a rub and towel, brushes, foot picks, you know, the basics, and rubbing alcohol and poultice. Well, where we're from, you know, we've got horses with problems. You know, we're holding them together with duct tape and painting them with these paints and, you know, and ball solutions and liniments and putting them in the ice tubs and all these kind of things. And I remember saying to one of the grooms, "Is that all you have in your groom box?" He says, "Yeah, yeah." I said, "Well, and what? How do you take care of the horses?" "Oh," he says, "they come up with little problems. They go to the farm." I was like, "Really? Because we got to get ours to the races."
That's a nice luxury to have.
Yeah, we got to learn to work on them. You know, you got to learn to do the leg work and how to keep these horses going that, you know, got issues. We can't afford to stop on them, you know, or just turn them out for a year. So that was kind of an eye opener and how some of the other operations work. But, you know, I like, you know, to me, that's how I came up. When I first started training, I was the only one that touched my horses. I galloped them, I groomed them, and I walked them. I did everything. And me and my wife did it all. We groomed them, we walked them, put them on the trailer, took them to the track, we ran them, took them to the paddocks ourselves. You see us in the winter circle, we're holding the horses and legging the horses up ourselves. So, we came from the bottom up.
Is there an advantage to coming up that way and learning from the ground up?
Right. What was that? Sorry, I didn't hear
you. Is there an advantage, Dale, to coming up that way and learning the process from the ground up?
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's first and foremost, it's hard work. You know, you're doing everything yourself. And, you know, you just learn how to do leg work and gallop the horses. And, you know, I'm not saying every trainer is not like that, but, you know, we know how to do everything, you know. We know how to load a horse and sail with them ourselves and everything from the bottom up, you know. So there's definitely an advantage, you know. We know how to do leg work and look at legs, and, you know, I think it's definitely an advantage.
Well, you mentioned your wife, Denise. She's a big part of your operation as well, isn't she?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. She's early on it started, you know, she was, you know, we did everything together. She was an ex-jockey, so we galloped our horses, and, you know, we put the bandages on them in the morning, bathed them, walked them, did all that. Now she's kind of moved away as we've gotten much bigger. She does a lot of all the paperwork, and, you know, she takes care of other employees and, you know, the ordering of the supplies and all that kind of stuff, you know. So, but I still get on horses myself and gallop horses in the morning.
Take me back to that. To that first year when you went out on your own, and you started with just three horses, didn't you?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that year. How hard was that?
Well, I was actually in Michigan, and I had actually gotten up to, like, you know, I had had three horses, and I was in Ocala. I was still working for my dad, and I had a couple horses for a guy that I had met, and one of the horses was an allowance horse, and I didn't want to blow his allowance condition at Tampa, because at that point the purses were cheap, and in Chicago they were big. So I sat on the horse, and my wife went back to Michigan to ride, and I went to Hawthorne myself, which was actually running in Sportsman's Park. And I won a race at Sportsman's. I claimed a couple of horses at that time in Chicago at Sportsman's. So when they moved over to Arlington, I didn't go to Arlington. I went back to Michigan. So I wanted to ship one of the horses was Illinois, but I wanted to ship him back to Chicago to run, and the racing secretary at the time in Michigan wouldn't let me. Or he said, if the horse leaves, don't bring him back, just, you know, because of the horse population, and he's being a little bit of a jerk. So the owner said, well, I'm not running him at Great Lakes Downs for that purse, you know, so I'm going to send him over to somebody else. So I told my wife, I think I had 8 or 9 at that time. I said, I'm giving those horses away. I'm going to Arlington with these three, and they're either going to kick my ass and send me home, or I'm going to make it, you know. So basically, I went there, and, you know, I was living in a dorm room. I lived in a dorm in Chicago for several years and did everything myself. And just basically, you know, I just started plucking away. I'd claim one and turn over and win. And, you know, my philosophy was always, I didn't try to protect the horses. I wanted to win. So I didn't care if I ran back and lost the horse. My wife would say, oh, you know, we need to pay horses. No, I need to win, you know, because I'm not just going to keep the horse in the stall. And, you know, I was young, a little bit brave. I was claiming off of Hollendorfer and kind of, I don't know, just, you know, just trying to, you know, prove myself. And, you know, we just kept slowly just, you know, the owner that I had, you know, he just left the money there and we'd claim another one. And, you know, I'd run it back and win with it and win and lose it. And I think I'd, you know, I'd rather have, you know, 3 horses in the stall, 5 starts and 3 wins than have 10 in the stall, you know, and 20 starts and 1 win. So I just was very aggressive, you know, just trying to make a name for myself there. If it didn't work out, then it didn't work out.
Yeah, talking with trainer Dale Bennett here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Dale, tell me the story of Splendor Buck.
A Splendor Buck, my wife bought him from past regrowth. You know, he's passed away now, and the horse was he was a nut, and he was on his way somewhere. I don't know if he was on his way to the killers or where he was going, but Reed Gross was loading in the trainer. My wife saw him, and he said, "How much you want for that horse?" And he says, "Here, you know, give me a dollar. I'll just get him out of here, you know." So we bought the horse, and sure enough, the first time we put a saddle on him, this horse was just nuts. He'd just go in every direction except forward. So, anyways, we started to work with him, and next thing you know, I don't know how many races we lost. Oh, 3, 4. We kind of took off the track record at BRC, but he was just one of those really nervous horses. But, you know, at the time, I think one of our first ones was Spirit of Austin. We were just getting horses that were broke down. One had Chip, another one we bought on the cuff, which means we didn't put any money out for him. We had to pay it back if he earned, and he was bowed. And Denise went on him, and he paid it. It was like 80-1. First time we ran him, and he won. So, yeah, but Splendor Buck, he was fast, but he was just, you know, one of these very nervous horses that just, you know, you had to figure out how to train him. We never put a saddle on, we just ponied him, just took him alongside with the pony, and then just ran him.
Yeah. Wow, what a great story. And to buy him for what, just a dollar, is that right?
Yeah, just a dollar. He said, here, give me a buck, and he just wanted to get rid of him.
Wow, that's a great story, and all of a sudden you're off and running, so to speak, with Splendor Buck. And your first winner was what, Spirit of Austin, is that right?
Yep.
That had to be a really special day to know that, you know, you persevered and you stuck with it, and all of a sudden, you know, you realized, hey, I can do this.
Yeah. Actually, I remember because the day that he won, I had to go borrow a bridle from my dad. I didn't have any horse equipment, you know, like bridles and stuff like that. We were just, like, as far as the racing, a nice clean racing bridle. We just had bridles for the morning, which was the training bridle. I remember I had to go borrow a bridle from him to run the horse. And actually, I think Denise she had gotten on him a few times in the morning and was working him. And for some reason, I don't know, it was a long time ago, I don't quite remember, she didn't get along with him. She didn't like him. Because otherwise she would have rode him, but then she said put Freddie Mata on the horse, and he ended up winning. So, yep, that was a long time ago.
Well, it's when you look back on your career and you see your numbers and your number of wins increase year after year after year, and you continue to build in a positive way. What would you say was the reason behind the key factor in your success right now, Dale?
Well, you know, a lot of it stems from my dad, you know, and hard work and you know, just really knowing the horses. And I think, you know, where you place them, you know, because, you know, look, and let's be realistic. At the end of the day, you know, it's about winning. You know, you need to win races, and that's what's going to attract the clients and be successful. And I just think that, you know, we don't shortchange our horses at all. What they need is what they get. I believe that you're not going to get anything out of them that you don't put in. So, you know, they're just very well taken care of. You do your leg work, and you put them in the right spots when they're ready. If they're doing well, put them in and give them a chance and put them in the right spot. And I think that's sort of a philosophy that, you know, I stuck with. And, you know, I've always said, you know, if you train scared and you're always afraid of, well, what if I put him in there and he gets claimed? Well, you're not going to win very many races when you train that way, you know, because if you put your horse in a spot and someone's looking at it and says, hey, this horse looks like it's worth the money, well, then you probably got the horse in the right spot. If you got a horse year in and year out and you're putting it in races and other trainers are looking at the form and saying, they just pass right over your horse, they're probably in over their head. And that's not a blanket statement. Obviously, it doesn't, you know, attain to every horse, but as a whole, you know what I mean? Like, it's just, if you're putting your horses in the right spot or you're getting their form looking as good as, and it's intriguing to other people where the form looks good and they look like they're worth the money, you're doing your job and you put it in the right spot. So you just have to, you know, stay steady and hopefully have the clients that allow you to do that and allow you to keep rebuilding. When you do lose the horses, you go ahead and you get more, you know, and then you kind of venture off of that into the younger horses. Like, I train for Savoy. He's not really a claiming guy, but he brings up a lot of young horses, and we buy a lot of yearlings and two-year-olds. So there's several different branches of how the business works. But I think it's just staying steady and true to what you believe and putting the horses where they belong. And, you know, usually, you know, you get the results.
What does Dale Bennett believe? What's your training philosophy?
Well, I'm not very hard on the horses in the morning. I don't train them every day. You know, after they run, you know, I don't have a problem with this. My dad's old school. He's old school. They run 2 days, they go back to the track, you know, and I've ventured off to my own opinion, but I believe in, you know, it may not be right or wrong, maybe I'm too soft on them, but I believe in giving them time, you know, after they run. When they start eating up real good, then they can go back to track, and I like to do a lot of jogging with them, you know, build up their hind end. So I'd rather have a fresh, happy horse than like one that is, you know, you're worried about fitness, but the horse can get sour or get bored. You know, it's every day, gallop, gallop, gallop. I don't like that. I like to keep them fresh, happy, healthy. So when they go out on the track, they want to do it. And it's not just another trip around the track and they're just going to go as fast as they can. I want them to kind of want to do it. They're ready, you know?
Yep.
So I think that's maybe my philosophy. Like, you know, I'll train 3 days in a row and then give them a day off, or I'll pony them, gallop them, just kind of mix it up. I just try to keep them happy.
Dale, you've had success with all types of horses, from claimers to allowance horses to stakes horses. And you talked about finding the right spot for the claiming horses. Is there a difference in your approach to training claimers as opposed to training horses that are going to run in stakes?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. And I know the answer is yes and no. I mean, they're all different. I mean, we claim a horse, you know, we assess it, you know, you watch him for the first few days that you get him. Is he a good eater? Can he handle the workload? You know, get him back in the feed tub. You know, are you getting a horse ready for a stake? Are you stretching him out from a sprint to a route? You know, we might stretch the workouts longer, 2 minute lift the horse to open the horse's lungs up. So every horse is treated as an individual and every situation is different, you know, so you can't train them all the same. You have to train them according to how they're like little kids. Now, some horses, you work them, they don't eat up for a few days. That's just how they are, you know. So you have to back off them a little bit, or some horses you can just, you know, they can handle a heavy workload and they just keep diving in the feed tub. Some horses have issues. They might have ankles that bug them a little bit, so you can't be as hard on them as the others. I always tell everybody, it's like coaching a football team. You've got some might need to sit out that day, you know, be out there for a general practice, blow their knee. I mean, you've got other horses that are problem horses. You know, they're all individuals and they all have their own personalities, and you have to adjust accordingly. That's basically the way I look at it, and that's how I treat the whole stable. It's like having a whole team of kids, or a whole football. I actually describe some of the horses, like some of them look like linebackers and some of them look like swimmers. You know, they're more narrow and thin. but it gives the owners a little bit of an idea how their horse looks. You know, I mean, this horse is, you know, he's built like Michael Phelps. You know, he looks like small, narrow, leggy. And then you got other ones, big, broad chest, big, broad shoulders. I mean, they look like Brian Urlacher. I mean, so they kind of get a little picture in their mind. And then their personalities are just the same. You know, some can handle it, some can't. Some are bad, some are good. And you have to handle them that way, you know, to try to get the most out of them.
Yeah, your dad was telling me that after doing this for so long, that he kind of gets the feeling, and he called it a sixth sense, that horses are communicating with him. Do you kind of feel that same way?
Absolutely. And you do it for so long, you can kind of walk down the shed and, let's say, ship a whole 3 van loads into another track. You can walk down the shed and just look at a horse and say, that horse, he's not feeling well. Look at him. His eyes are down. The horse is down. You know, you can walk by a stall. If you know your horses, that's the thing. If you feed your horses every day and you got one that's charging the stall, he's pawing, he's hollering, he's ready for his feed, and the next day you go down and the horse is just kind of standing there. Well, you better address it. You better check his temperature, see what's wrong, because you get to know them, you know. And, you know, you can just tell by a horse's demeanor coming on and off the racetrack in the morning if they're bouncing or they're full of energy. But you can look at a horse and just kind of look in his eyes and just, you know if they're ready on race day. You know, they're just, I absolutely believe that. When you're doing it for long enough, you can watch a horse cooling out in the morning and you'll just say, that horse is left front, he's not walking right, you know, or the horse is tying up or very mildly, you know, we need to pull some blood work. So yeah, I mean, experience, there's a lot to be said for experience, for sure. I mean, my dad's probably forgotten more than most trainers even know.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt about that. And when you look at everything that he's accomplished and what you've been able to do in your career so far, and it really is remarkable. And I can see the same sense of determination in you that he talked about when he was working at A&P and working till 3:30 in the morning and then going to the barns in the morning. It's... that apple hasn't fallen very far from the tree.
Yeah, well, when I first started out, I was galloping horses for Donnie Rowe and multiple trainers in Thistle Downs, and I had my 3 on the side, but I would gallop 10, 12, and then go over and get my own out and, you know, take them over to the pool, gallop them, and then start with the leg work and bandages and do them up. And, you know, so it definitely all started from there. But, you know, my dad and I, we both, you know, you're still – when we're in Tampa, we sit in the same box and watch our horses run, and we holler as loud today as we did 15, 20 years ago. And, you know, we both want to win that bad. I think when you start to accept losing, you know, you're probably on your way out. Like, but I always tell my wife, she gets mad at me because I get mad when we lose. You know, you need to calm down. Listen, I want to win. I hate to lose. I hate it. The best feeling is winning. You know, that's what we're here for. That's my job. And when I start saying, you know, well, it's okay, ran fourth, and no, that's not okay. We need to fix it. We need to find another spot for the horse or find out why he ran bad. I mean, I never bet on my horses. It's something I don't do. Something I don't believe I need to worry about is the gambling aspect. I don't want to worry about why I lost my – be mad by I lost $100. I want to figure out why the horse lost.
Yeah.
You know? So I, if the horse wins, I make money. So I don't need to worry about betting on them. I don't remember the last time I bet on one of my horses.
Yeah, every time you saddle one, it's a bet.
Absolutely. You know, I have people to answer to. That's enough problems. You know, I don't need to worry about losing $100 or whatever and trying to hit an exacta and everything. I don't need to. But, you know, I was a big part of my dad's operation way, 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 way back when in Detroit. You know, they were having a lot of horses and hitting gimmicks and stuff. But those were the fun days. It's not like that anymore.
Well, Dale, this whole show has been a lot of fun to hear from your dad in the first half of the show and then to hear from you. And again, just like your dad, I could spend much more time with you. So we'll have to do a part 2 with Dale Bennett up the road. But I want to wish you all the best now. And all of our guests receive a gift courtesy of one of our sponsors. It's Flair Equine Nasal Strips. So I'll send those out to you and appreciate the time, my friend. Good luck.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And Dale Bennett, his dad, Gerald. If you missed any portion of the show, go to our website, horseracingradio.net, a podcast available there and on iTunes. iTunes, and on Ken McPeak's Horse Races Now app. It's all there for you to listen to at your leisure. Been a lot of fun. For my producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton.